Hi, everybody. I'm going to get started. Just a quick reminder, The midterm is a week from Wednesday. And next Wednesday, we're going to meet at the lab. So don't come here for the next lecture. Also, I would like to ask if anybody has any questions about homework 4. Yeah. It's enough to that there's one for full credit. Yeah. Anything else? Yeah.
For the card, just what constitutes animation as far as
the any moving, gliding. I guess gliding looks more like animation. Moving and waiting, turning around, anything that moves. We had some stuff in the computer lab with a swimmer that was swimming. Yeah. A what?
A meme.
What is that? Like if you're in it?
No, if our card becomes that.
Yeah, but I don't know what a meme is.
A viral video. A viral social.
Why would you do that?
Why not?
Well, let me think about that, and I'll get back to you. Maybe you should, I mean, this class discourages harmful, any kind of harmful behavior, so I know there's a lot of temptation, but I don't know. I'll think about it. Anything else? No questions? About the homework? Okay. So that's due on Wednesday, too. And by that, I mean homework 4. Okay, so today we're going to continue with talking about subroutines and randomness. And we're just going to start with a few quicker questions, like usual. We talked about the correct use of the word exponential last time. And so which one of the following quotes is the correct use of the word exponential? I'm just going to read them just for the people who are at home, you know, listening to the podcast. A, it was the biggest event yet in the annual ritual that seemed to swell exponentially with each year. B, when opponents get to know him, he's going to have to expand his repertoire exponentially. C, but the avalanche of correspondence, which exponentially exceeds the number of letters in a typical criminal case, suggested that there were few people who hadn't been touched by Kushner's kindness. D, but this year the challenge grew exponentially when we tried to add our new puppy into the scene. And I'll start this. Five more seconds. You could be a little more subtle when you're talking to each other, that would be great. Okay, stopping. Okay, people think A is the correct one, and I agree. So why are the other ones... Okay, so why is A correct? Well, we said that in order to use the word exponentially correct, you have to mean some kind of trend of growth. You can't just mean a lot more. So a lot of people compare two things and use it incorrectly, therefore. It was the biggest event yet in the annual ritual that seemed to swell exponentially with each year. So in this case, we can see there's a trend of growth. Each year, there's exponentially more, you know, people coming to the event, whatever. Word B, it's comparing before the opponents get to know him to after the opponents get to know him. After the opponents get to know him, he's going to have to expand his repertoire a lot more. He's going to have tons more whatever his repertoire is. For C, it's comparing the other criminal cases with the criminal case that they're talking about. So that's, again, comparing two things, which makes it incorrect. And then, again, in D, we're, again, trying to compare the situation before we had the puppy with the situation after we had the puppy. So it's, again, comparing two things. All right, so I'm going to skip these correct uses of the word exponential. Let's do this one. We talked about growth a little bit. So in this question is, if you have a function, S of n, a function of n, which is n plus n plus da 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 n times. So whatever n is, it's adding up n times. How does S of n grow as n increases? What is the big O of S of n? And the options are A, it's big O of log n. B, it's big O of n. C, it's big O of n log n. D, it's big O of n squared. And E, it's big O of 2 to the n. Stopping in 5. Stopping. Okay, a very controversial problem again. So, what is a shorter way of writing this expression? Can somebody tell me? More compact way, without the dots. Go ahead. Sure, and without the summation. So, without, yeah, sure. You can write summation and, okay, right? Okay, this is not going to help a lot of people, I don't think. But what about, it's a good one. It doesn't have the dots. What about another one? What's a short way of writing it?
N squared.
Okay, so what is this? This is n plus n plus n, da, 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 n times, right? So it's n times n. We're adding up n times, which is n squared. Any questions? Are you sure? Because there's other ones coming. All right. So what about T of n? T of n is 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus da 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 plus 1 n times. How does T of n grow as n increases? And again, you have options A log n, B big O of n, let me start over. A big O of log n, B big O of n, C big O of n log n, D big O of n squared, E big O of 2 to the n. Stopping at 120. Stopping. All right. Right answer, majority votes. So this one is I guess D was also popular. Okay.
So this one is, we add up 1 n times. How many 1s are we going to have? Well, it's 1 or n times 1, which is n. And that's going to go with n. Any questions about this one?
Okay, third one is the trickiest. And it's U of n is 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus dot 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 plus n. So it's a sum of the first n numbers. If n grows, how does U of n grow as n increases? And you have the same options. We did this one last time, kind of. I'll stop at 140. Stopping? So the popular answers are log of n and n log n. Okay. So let's do this one. This one, the reason I think people said stuff that involved log n is because of the songs. And when you have a song, if you count like the bottles of beer song, that's like big O of n log n or something like that. In this case, though, this summation, we kind of found a short short formula for it. And the way we did it was, we said, how many squares are in, if we make up this formula with one square plus two squares plus three squares plus n squares, how many squares are going to be in this drawing? And we said that we can make an exact copy of this and kind of copy it on top. And then we got a rectangle where this, one of the sides was n, and the other side was n plus 1. Because this is the initial one, and then you put the copy on top, and there's an extra square that comes here. And so, twice times U of n, we said, twice times this sum, was n times n plus 1. Because that's how many squares are in that rectangle. A rectangle of n by n plus 1, that's going to be the area of that rectangle. And so U of n is going to be n times n plus 1 over 2. And we can write it, we can distribute the n, and also distribute the denominator. It's going to be half times n squared plus half times n. Right, because it's n squared plus n over 2. I'm distributing the denominator. And when we, so that's U of n, the shortest word, without the dots. So we said that the way we compute big O of n is we discard the least significant terms. In this case, n squared grows faster than n. And so we're going to forget about this one. And then we ignore the constants. So that gives us the big O of. Okay. So that's just in terms of numbers. It's not in terms of songs. When you have songs and you have counting in the songs, they usually involve a login because, well, we explained that myself. I'm not going to go over that. Any questions? This is a very important formula to remember, by the way. It's very good to know it. All right, so we said with the song growth, we talked about song and how songs grow in terms of the number of syllables. We had linear songs, which all verses are the same length. Quadratic songs, where each verse adds a line or two, constant number of syllables to the song, and they grow quadratically. And then you have songs like "But the Bottles of Beer" song or the monkey song, anything that counts going up or going down, is going to be an log n song. So today we're going to talk a little bit about this. There's a lot of philosophical terms in computer science, and I'm going to talk more about them towards the end of the semester. I would just like to explain a few concepts right now, because we're going to be talking about what does it mean that computers are powerful, or how powerful are they, or how much can they compute? What does it mean to compute something? So I'd like to talk a little bit about that. Philosophy usually doesn't care about some areas in science, but unfortunately, computer science is not so lucky. And by that, I mean they just like to tease us a lot about, what does it mean to know something when we say we can make a computer know or learn. What is intelligence? We talk about artificial intelligence. What does that mean? What can computers do? And kind of what is the difference between the way people think and the way computers think? And, computer scientists think about those things a lot, because we get a lot of inspiration from, the way people think and the way, things happen in nature. And so, for example, some things that some criticism that philosophers say is that, for example, nobody actually gets wet from a simulation of a hurricane, which is true, and we like that. That's why we have simulations, so that nobody would get hurt or wet. They can't translate human languages, it depends. So there's languages that are very hard to translate. There's languages like Chinese. If you use, Google has a translator. If you use that for Chinese and you can speak both Chinese and English, you can see how badly it does. There are certain languages that are better, that they do better than other languages. I think they're gonna get there. I think with enough structure and explaining, knowing enough about a language can help you, make a better translation between English and that language. They don't really know about themselves. You make a computer, you tell it what to do, but it doesn't understand itself. It doesn't think about itself. People do. People think a lot about, themselves. They reflect. They're very conscious of themselves, which computers don't. Just personally, I think these things are really good. I think that the fact that computers don't have emotion is a really good thing. Because imagine you would be, calling a bank, and they have the voice recognition system, and they do a horrible job sometimes. And they're like, "Did you say this?" And you're like, "No, I said this." And then if they would get impatient, it would be very painful. We would never get anywhere. So I think that's a very good attribute of computers, that they're very kind of cold and they don't have emotions, and they're very good at the tasks that they're designed for. But people are trying to put emotions or simulate emotions, and that's okay too. Because people like to have, when you go home, if your computer were to talk to you, you'd like to feel like it understands you, or they have all kinds of things like, "What is your mood?" And you tell it, "I'm depressed." And then they, they play certain kind of music, and they have certain colors that have been scientifically demonstrated that they improve your mood and so on. So about computer power, what does it mean that something is powerful, can simulate something else? What does it mean? What is computer power? So imagine that I would like to play the game of Mario, and let's say that I do not have a computer. Let's say that I do not have the game. I could use, a game simulator, and it has, I think this is Nestopia. They have, you put a card in it, and then you plug it to the TV. That's what people used to do. And, you can just play the game. So it's almost like your machine can run that game. Now, what if you don't have a game simulator, but you have a computer? The computer can simulate Nestopia. It can do whatever Nestopia can do, a computer can do. You just install, there's all kinds of software on the internet, and it can just actually act like the game simulator. And, you know, this is good for people who, let's say, have been used to, you know, the more basic devices. They can actually, if they get a computer, they can actually get the same feel as they did with, you know, the older devices that can do that much. But this means that the computer is more powerful than the Nestopia. Because whatever, again, whatever the Nestopia can do, the computer can do. Nestopia is not more powerful than the computer because there are things that the computer can do that Nestopia cannot do. Now, what if you don't have a PC, but you have a Mac? What can you do? Well, you can use iEmulator or something. And you can emulate, you can use, you know, like a virtual machine that actually emulates the PC, right? And so this means that the Mac is more powerful than the PC. But also, sorry, another thing, another error that I didn't do was there's also virtual machines that you can run on the PC, and it can do whatever a Mac can do, a PC will be able to do. So that means that they're equally powerful. So that's kind of the idea of the computer power. Whatever, if a computer is more powerful or a device is more powerful than the other, if whatever that second device can do, the first device can also do. And there's this whole thinking about computing and thinking about intelligence and thinking about, you know, kind of, there's a dream from the 50s, I think, that what, you know, you can compute anything, you can simulate anything. And this is the Church-Turing thesis. And they're kind of saying that any machine computation can be, so any computation in the world, in the universe, can be carried out on a Turing machine. And a Turing machine is just a computer, which it's kind of an idealized idea of a computer. And so, you know, they go as far as to say that, you know, brains of people are physical systems, so we could be able to simulate a human brain with a computer, which, so now artificial intelligence people kind of divide into groups of people. Some people think that there will be a time when people will be able to make a computer that will think exactly like a person, and there are people who believe that that time will never come. So just mathematically, there's something called the Turing test. And a Turing test is something that tests a machine, and if the machine passes the Turing test, that means that it's intelligent. That means that we cannot distinguish between a machine and a person or a human. If the machine fails the Turing test, then, you know, they're more limited than a person. And so there's not, to my knowledge, there hasn't been any computer or software that has passed the Turing test yet. But let me just explain what the Turing test is. Let's say that you have a person and they're IMing with somebody else on the internet, one of their friends. And if they're thinking that they're talking to a person, if they're absolutely positive that they're talking to a person, if at the other end there's a computer, a software, any kind of, you know, Alice, whatever, if the thing that they're talking to is a computer, that means that the computer passes the Turing test. And people have tried really hard to make, you know, websites and all kinds of agents and that actually, you know, act, talk like humans, but people haven't been fooled yet. So again, there's people who believe that this is going to be possible. There's people who believe that this is never going to be possible. I'm actually one of those in the second category, because I think that you're always going to be able to figure out that the computer is a computer. You're always going to be able, after you talk to it for a while, you're going to be able to figure it out. So another interesting idea is the idea of randomness. And this is connected to the previous idea, because one thing that separates machines from people is just the capacity of people to just make up something totally random. You know, you can talk to somebody and they're just out of the blue, they say something random. It's not completely random, but to you it doesn't seem random. And you know, weather it's not random. But, you know, it's impossible to predict. Even prediction for 3 days are, you know, fail. So weather prediction is pretty bad. And what is, but you know, computers need randomness, and we're going to be talking about why they need randomness. It actually helps a lot, and a lot of things in computer science would not be possible without randomness. But so one example is to speed up their computation, and we're going to see that. But how can you make a computer that's like, you know, do this, do that? We saw the gates. This comes in, this comes out. They're very deterministic. They're very fixed. How can we make them do something random? And we can't. That's the answer. But we can actually make them pretend that they're random. And it's also called pseudo-random. Pseudo means false. So it can look random, but it's actually not random. So, you know, knowing that computers are, everything in a computer is represented by a series of bits, how would we be able to make random numbers? What do you think? Yeah.
Calculate the time to 10 decimal places that a certain point can take the last three as a number.
Is that the current time?
The current time as of a certain button place.
That's a good idea. I was trying to go back to bits. So that number is represented by bits, right?
Zeros and ones, but then you take it to like, oh, I don't know, 10 or a couple hundred decimal places.
Right.
And then you take the last zeros and ones as a binary.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Anything else? Any other ideas? So basically in a computer, if we want to make random numbers, if we want to make random bits, we basically have a coin, and we flip a coin for each random bit that we want to make. So if we want to make a number, an integer, between, you know, between 0 and 31, we're going to have need 5 bits, right? And so we're going to have to flip a coin 5 times. So how can you, for example, how can you make a random number between 0 and 33? No, 0 and 33. With just a coin. Let's say you have a penny and you need to decide between 4 flavors of ice cream. How would you do that? Why is a coin not enough to make a choice between among 4 things? Right. With one coin, you can only have two choices, right? And you can choose, make one choice between 2 things. But what if you need more than that? How can you use that coin? Yeah. Exactly. So we can say that. Well, we just declared that heads is 1 and tails is 0. And with 2 coin flips, we can make a 2-bit number. We can make either 0, 0 if there's tails, tails, 0, 1, or 0, 1, 1. So those are 4 choices. We can make, we have 2 coin flips. So basically, for each bit that we need a coin flip. What about from 0 to 15? Make a number between. We have 16 choices. How would you do that? You want each choice to have equal probability. So what's the probability here? What's the probability of getting tails to tails here? Each choice has a 4. So we like that. We want equal probability. Good. What about between 0 and 15? Right, so you need, exactly, so numbers between 0, you have to represent the numbers in binary and figure it out. So that's 0, and that's 15, is this. And so you need 4 bits, so you're going to have 4 coin flips. So with 4 coin flips, that gives you a random number between 0 and 15, and then you can convert it to decimal and get your choice. What about 0 to 2? If you want... So you want 0 or 1 or 2 with the same number. the problem here. Well, let's try, I mean, any ideas work. So let's ignore the equal probabilities for now. How would you do it? If you had to choose between three things and you really had no idea, and you wanted to flip a coin, how would you do it? If you had a coin. Flip the coin three times, okay? So, and then how do you assign your choice? So you get three bits, right? Let's say it's tails, heads. So in Scratch, also we saw for the first lab, we can use the random. There's a block called pick random between 0 and 1, for example, in this case. So if we want to make a random bit in Scratch, we could just see, we can make a subroutine that returns a random bit, and it just says pick random 0 to 1, and that is going to give us 0 or 1 randomly. If we wanted to do random 4, we need two variables, we need two bits, we need bit 1 and bit 2. We generate randomly a bit, bit 1 we call random bit, so we generate randomly. We generate bit 2 randomly, and then the answer is going to be twice times bit 1, bit 2 plus bit 1, right? That's how we convert from binary to decimal. And then you can do all kinds of things like bit 16, which is going to be a little more complicated, and then with bit 3, you have to say, repeat until answer is smaller than 3. So as long as you get heads, you have to stay in the loop and keep flipping coins. And if you have gotten an answer that's smaller than 3, then you have your answer. You make a random bit, and then you make 2 random bits, and then you have your answer. And so these are a few shortcuts which are pretty important to remember, because there's going to be some problems about them. If you have an event that has a certain probability, you need 1 over, so probability p, you need 1 over p tries before it happens on average. So if your event is getting zero on your coin flip or you're choosing a random number, and it has probability 1 over 4. On average, so if p equals 1 over 4, on average you need 1 over p, which is 1 over 1 over 4, which is 4 times, to repeat the experiment before you get that event happen. So your event is getting 0. Or if you have, let's see, if you have a die, if you have a dice and you roll it, what's the probability of 2? 1 6. How many times on average do you have to roll the dice before you get 2? 6. Okay, good. If n distinct events are equally likely, about n log n, you have to do about n log n tries before you see all n of them. So if you don't care about the order, it's n log n. If you care about the order, it's n squared. You don't really have to understand it. It's just something that will help you solve problems. And also another important thing is if I start with a number n, I can cut it in half a number of log n times before 1 is reached. So what if, let's do this one. What if I have to, I choose, if I start with a number 133, how many times can I split it in half before I reach 1? Well, I can just start dividing it in 2, and that's fine. And then count how many times I'm dividing it in 2. Or I can just use my computer and do log base root of 133. When you talk about log to that sign, this is probably going to be something like 7, a little more than 7, 7 dot something, which means that 2 to the 7 is approximately 133. That's 128. Okay, so the log instead is the inverse of the exponential function. Okay, so we started, again, short recap, we started with small level bits, gates, and we worked up to a higher level language. So now we will take the stuff that we have, take the capabilities that we have, and we're going to try to create new capabilities. And so what if we have an entire computer? What can we do with an entire computer? And the answer is algorithms. So algorithms are, if you are given a problem, the algorithm is a method to solve it. And the whole point in research in algorithms is to find the most efficient way to solve the problem, the simplest way, the way that takes the least time, and with the least amount of work. And we're going to talk about what does time mean? How does that get measured? And so let's take an example of an algorithm. If you have a recipe is an algorithm. It's almost like you have a box, and the ingredients go in, and the food comes out. And the algorithm tells you, step one, you do this. Step two, you do this. Step three, you do this. Another example, which is more close to this class, is the truth table to formula algorithm, which is the method of going, taking a truth table and finding the formula. And you guys have to do this for homework. So let's say you are given a truth table, and then you follow the steps. You just follow the method. Step one, you make an AND clause for each sequel is false. This was where it's mostly false, I think, mostly true. Then you OR the clauses together, you negate the answer, and then you get your answer simplified. So that's your output of the algorithm. Another example is, this is kind of a silly example, but we're going to use it because I think it's a little easier to understand. Then we're going to move on to more complicated examples. So let's say you have the problem of matching your socks. Let's say you went to the laundromat, and then you have a bag full of socks, and you are trying to, they're mixed up, so you're trying to put them together. And the purpose is you have to reach in the basket the least number of times. What's a method of doing it? You have multiple operations that are available to you. You can test this if the basket is empty, but you can't look in it. You just know, you know, some, let's say a light comes off, goes off on the basket when it's empty. So you know exactly at each point in time if the basket is empty. You can grab a sock from the basket. You can test if two socks match, or, you know, if they make a pair. You can make a pair. If two socks match, you can match them up. Or if you don't like a sock, you can toss it back in the basket. So those are the things that you can do. So let's think about how we would solve this problem. One way of solving it is you could grab a sock from the basket. You could grab another sock from the basket. If they match together, I think if they don't match, you toss them back in the basket. And if they match, you make a pair, right? So take a sock, take another sock. If they don't match, put them back. If they match, put them, set them aside. Will this ever work? Would this procedure ever work, you think? Is it possible to work if you have five pairs of socks, let's say, and you do this? Do you think it will work? Can it work? Yeah? Will it always work? What's the worst case? You can get the same sock and they're not matching, right? And then you're stuck. It runs forever. So, but, you know, normally if you make sure that you mix the basket, we're pretty sure that it will end at some point. But we're going to try to make it, if you have five pairs of socks, what's the smallest amount of times you're going to reach in the basket? 10 times, right. Because you're going to have to reach in the basket for each pair of socks. So if you have n pair of socks, what's the number of times? 2 times n, if you have, if all your socks in the basket are matched up. What about the maximum number? What's the maximum number of times you will need to have to reach in the basket? The biggest possible number. 2n? To the n? Why is that? What if one of the socks doesn't match? What's the number of times you're going to have to reach before you pair them all up? Anyone want to try? What if you have 10 socks? Five pairs of socks. What's the maximum number of times you might have to reach in the basket? It's infinity, right? Like if you don't, you might grab the same two socks that don't match all the time. Okay, so what about, let's try to improve this. This is a pretty bad algorithm, right? You agree with me that it's pretty inefficient? If you were to do that, you wouldn't use this method. What about this one? Say you have a bed, and you can, if you grab a sock, so what you do is you repeat until the basket is empty. You grab a sock. If you don't see its match on the bed, you put the sock on the bed. And if you see its match on the bed, you make the pair with the sock on the bed. So you grab the sock on the bed, you grab the sock that you have in your hand, you match them together, and they're done. Okay? What if you have 8 pairs of socks, 5 pairs of socks? How many times will you need to grab in the basket if everything goes the smallest amount of times? Let's say 5 pairs of socks. So again, you grab a sock. Yeah, go. It's 2n, right? Because you have to grab each sock from the basket. What's the worst case? What's the biggest amount of times you will need to... What's the biggest time you'll need to reach into the basket? Did you want to say something? And you have 2n socks. Well, if you do N, did you say N? N, 10, 10. Sorry, 10 sounds like N. Okay. So, 10 socks, right? Because if they don't match, you don't put the sock back in the basket. You only have to reach for each sock one time. So this is pretty good, right? The min, the max, the average, they're all equal. Every single time, it's going to be equal to 2N. And even if there's some kind of problem in there, like, you know, one of the socks doesn't match, you're okay because you'll only reach once and only once for each sock in the basket. So you can go on forever. And it's always 10 or 2N. So what do you think if there are two people here and I brought a basket of socks and I gave them and they competed, which one do you think would win? Which one would you think would pair the socks the fastest? Sock bee, right? It's much more efficient. The worst case for sock bee is the best case for sock A. So it's definitely, they would definitely finish, on average, they would finish sooner. So the problem with sock bees that we use the bed, we might not have that kind of space. And, you know, the analogy with algorithm is that, that means memory. We might not have that memory. We might not have that space available. We would like to do something where we would not need the bed, but that wouldn't be as bad as sock sorter A. Can we make a compromise between sock A and sock B, the sorters? Any improvement on sock A would be great, because sock A is pretty bad. What's that? Anybody? So you have a bulk bag and you...
Don't go
both back. Okay, so how's your algorithm work? You grab a sock, you grab another sock, and you just throw the one of them back in? That's a really good idea, right? I think this is my sorter. So if the... you repeat until the basket is empty, you grab a sock, you grab the second sock, you repeat until they match, you toss back only the second sock, and then you grab another sock. And so you only toss back the second sock, so then the probability of getting the right, pair, the right matching sock is bigger if you don't have to, toss them both back. So that's a really good one. And actually it works. What's the worst case in this case? Did we improve the worst case? Did we improve the, worst case scenario if nature is against us? No, right? Because we can still go for, we can still go for infinity. We can still, something can be, okay, let's say there's a sock that doesn't have a match. And that's a sock that we grab. We're going to toss it, toss whatever sock we grab, the second sock, for eternity, or until we get bored, and we will never find the matching pair. So, which one do you think that in between sock A and sock C, which one do you think would do better? Sock sorter C on average, that's definitely true. Okay, and so it's roughly the same number of operations. But, the probability of matching a pair is much, much bigger in this case. And we can kind of have an intuition about that. So this is an example of a problem for which we have three methods. And some methods are better than other methods. Some methods are worse than other methods. And so these are three algorithms that we can use to solve the problem. If we were to choose a method to solve it, we would definitely choose, and we had the space, we had the bed, we would definitely choose B, right? If we don't have the bed, we'd probably choose C. So each one of them has different requirements. B needed the extra space, A and C didn't. In real life, we're going to be faced with choosing what the best method is. And so we can compare different algorithms based on what we're interested in, based on what things take more time. Let's say we really hate doing one operations. We really hate grabbing a sock from the bed, from the basket. We're going to say that's a really expensive task, that we really don't like it, and we would like to do something that minimizes the number of times we need to reach in the basket. And so Something that's more real or something that's closer to the purpose of this class. You know, we're not going to sort socks or anything. But we've talked about lists. And a very helpful problem is, you know, given a list, make a decision about it. Does this list contain number 7? Does the sum of the elements sum up? Do the elements sum up to a certain number? And that will be the main focus of our lab on Wednesday. So every problem needs to have a very well-defined input and a very well-defined output. So if you want me to give you a method to solve a problem, you're going to tell me you are given a list of numbers, and you need to give me the sum of the numbers. So everything needs to be very well defined. Otherwise, it's going to be very hard to solve the problem. So let's see. So our decision problems are going to be the box, the method, will answer true or false. You are going to be asking a question about a list. And the method is going to say, this is true of the list or this is false of the list. And so what kind of problems can we imagine on this? Let's say that the list is the phone book, right? What kind of problems can you imagine that would be useful to people if our list is everybody in the phone book for New Brunswick, for example, New Brunswick, New Jersey? What are the questions that we might want to ask? Well, if somebody, or one of our friends, is in the phone book, we might want their information. We might want to call them up if they have, if they're listed. Maybe, I don't know, if the phone book has their address, we might want to know that, and so on. Okay, so one example of a problem is the number X in the list. So you're given a list of numbers, and a number X, and is the number X in the list? And let's do, I guess we can do this as a quicker question. Try as fast as you can to answer is 83 in the list. I'm going to show you the list in a second. Press A if it's true and B if it's false, if the answer is false. So I'm going to get this started. I'm going to give you the list. That's the list. So the question is 83 in this list? I'll stop at 20. Well, maybe not. 30? 5 seconds. All right, so the answer was A, for most people. 83 was in the list. Okay? So do you think this is an easy problem? It's an easy problem. So what did you have to do to solve this problem? How did you, what was your algorithm? What was your method? Yeah. Exactly. So what you do is, you start at the beginning of the list, which let's say is the left, and then you say 48. Is 48 equal to 83? No. You move on until you run into 83, and then you don't even have to finish the list, right? Because you know your answer. So in this case, the answer will be true. Okay. So this is what the scratch problem could be. This is what the scratch script could look like. You set X is your number, to 83, and then you click some kind of sprite or whenever you want to start the script. You set I to 1, we had this before, you have a counter that kind of goes through the list, and I is the item number that you're going to be looking at. So if you repeat until I is bigger than the length of the list, you don't have to get off the list. When you're done with the list, you have to stop. If the item I of list is equal to X, you say yes and you stop the script. You don't have to continue with it. If, you know, your item wasn't equal to X, you have to move on, and you change I by 1. And at the end, if you never found the number, you say no. So that's an example of a decision problem. You have to go, through the whole list and check each item. What is the best case? If you have a list of N numbers, How long will this take? How many numbers does the cat need to look at, in the best case? When what is so? She said just one. When is that? When the first element of the list is 83, you're done after you've only looked at one number. So that's the best case. What is the worst case if you have n numbers? N, right? Because you have to look at each element in the list. Is there any way to do it faster than n? Not really, because you still have to look at the whole list, right? Okay, so this is kind of the anatomy of a loop, and I'm trying to go through this so it's a little easier on Wednesday. So you start by setting the initial conditions. You need to set your x. You need to set the i also, and then you have to run through each element of the list. And again, you use the variable i to point at each of these elements. You test. Test each element for the condition that you're looking for. If, you know, the question is 83 in the list, is X in the list? And at the end, you report the answer, which can be either yes or no. So let's see. The question is now, if the sum of the numbers is divisible by 5, and that means when you add up all the elements in the list, is that going to give you a number that ends in 0 or 5 or not? Okay, so are you ready? Let me get this started. That's your list. I'll stop at 120. I'm stopping. All right. Good. How can somebody tell me how you did it? Yeah. Oh, well. You raised your hand before I asked the question.
Yeah.
That's very fast. All right.
I just added the, like, it was 48 and 14. I added 8, 4. I just went down.
I see. So you only looked at the last digit.
Yes.
You didn't look at the whole number. How did you choose 48 and 14? Why did you skip 40?
It was 0.
Okay. So we don't need to add numbers that are end in 0 or 5, right? Because they're not going to change. Adding them is not going to change the answer. That's a good observation. One way to do it is add up all the numbers. I haven't seen too many people calculators, cell phones. Which is fine. That's one way of doing it. Just add up all the numbers and see if the sum is divisible by 5. If you had 100 numbers, your cell phone would probably explode. Well, it wouldn't explode. It would just, you know, not give you the right answer. But one way to speed it up, like one step of speeding it up, is to only add numbers that are not divisible by 5. You can only add those up. And another way to speed it up would be to just add the last digit of the numbers that are not divisible by 5. So it'd basically be 8 plus 4 from 48 and 14. That's a 2. Plus 6, it's an 8. Plus 1, it's a 9. Plus 7, it's a 6. Plus 2 and plus 2 is 0. 1 plus 5 is 6. Plus 3 is 9. Plus 4, I don't know how I'm doing this. Plus 4, it's 13. 16. 20, so 4, and then 4 plus 2 is 6. So it doesn't end in 0 or 5, it's not divisible by 5. Okay, good. So the way we do this, and I think we already did it before with clicker questions, again, you need to keep a running sum of all the numbers in the list. Otherwise, there's no way it's going to happen. So total is going to be a variable that's going to store the sum of all the numbers in the list. And then you set your i21, you make your little loop that goes through the whole list, and then you change the total by item I of list. So you go through the whole list, and then you add to the total the current number in the list. And you say the total, and then you divide it, you have mod 5. Mod gives you the remainder when you divide by 5. So if it's 0, that means the number is divisible by 5. You say yes. If the number is not divisible by 5, you say no. How many elements do you need to touch? How many elements do you need to look at to solve this problem? If the list is size n, you have n elements. If you're doing it this way. How many numbers do you need to look at? So when you were doing this, and let's say you were at the computer, how many numbers did you have to look at? Right, but you still need to look at the numbers that end in 0 or 5, because you have to decide if they end in 0 or 5. Right, and also our script is looking at each number. So how many numbers do you need to look at? All of them, right, n numbers. Was this a little harder than the previous problem, do you think? I think it was. The previous problem we did in 30 seconds, this problem we did in 1 minute and 20 seconds, I think. So this is definitely a harder problem. So you also get this notion of some problems are easier, some problems are harder. There's a whole spectrum of problems. What about the max? What's the biggest number in a list? It's a yes-no question. So the question is the max equal to X? So you're given a list of numbers, and you have to answer. You're given a list of number, a number X, and you have to say, decide if the maximum of the list is equal to that number. So we're going to get another list. I'm going to get this started. And here's your list. The question is the max equal to 98? Stop at 40. Stopping? All right. I don't understand. All right. So was this easier than the previous problem?
Yes.
Absolutely. Okay, how did you do it? Who wants to tell me how they did it? What was their algorithm? Yeah.
I looked for the largest first digit, and then the largest, and then figured out what most of those.
Very good. So what Rina did, she chose all the numbers that have the first digit, the largest number. So she kind of scanned through the list, and she looked at, she kind of probably selected 97 and 90. And then you have to look in a much smaller list. That's good. Another method to do it? That's another method. Turns out computers are pretty bad at looking at the first digit and then looking at the second digit. So a lot of people, if you want to write smaller code, you don't really care if the loop is pretty big. You just don't want to write that much. You're not going to, we are going to use methods that look at the first and the second digits, but the computers, we're just going to run through the whole list most of the time. But what's another way of doing it? Yeah. Okay, I see. So, Jasmine, look at all the, you said that you selected all the numbers that are bigger than, you looked for numbers that are bigger than 98 and all numbers that are smaller than 98 and not
982? I guess I looked each number, but 48 is lower or higher.
I see. Right. Okay, so one way to do this is to keep in mind what is the biggest number you've seen so far as you go through the list. And you can go, okay, 48, that's the biggest number I've seen so far. 40, well, 48 was bigger, so remember 48. 14, remember 48. 46, remember 48. And so on. Whenever you run into a number like 63 is bigger than 48. Forget about 48. I'm going to remember 63. And that's the biggest number I've seen so far. When you're done with the list, you're going to remember, know the biggest number. Biggest number in this list is 97, so the answer is no. And in Scratch, we do, we remember this largest number. We set it to zero. We start by assuming that it's zero. And then we run through the list, and what we do is, if the current item, if item I of the list is bigger than the largest number we've seen so far, we just replace the largest number with the current item I of the list. And then we say the largest number, and then if the largest number is equal to X, we say yes, and otherwise we say no. So if a list is N, how many elements do we need to look at in this list? How many elements in the best case? In the perfect world, smallest number of operations. What is the best scenario? It's the smallest number of numbers we need to look at. Yeah. What's that?
One.
When is that? How do we know that the largest is the largest number in the list? Right, if it's a billion, then the last number of the list, right? So you will have to, if the list is unsorted, you have to go through. What if the list was sorted? How many elements do you need to look at to find the biggest number in the list? If you get a sorted list, right? And I ask you, what is the biggest number in this list? How many numbers do you need to look at? It doesn't matter. You have access to all the elements. But the question is, you have to go systematically through the list, or can you just look at one element in the list? And you can. You can look at the last element if you want. If you have a phone book, you can look at the last person in the phone book. That's okay. But if I ask you who's the last person in the phone book, you can just open the phone book at the last page and tell me what the name of the person is, right? Yeah. Yeah, I'm talking about names. So imagine that we are looking at the last person in terms of names, the biggest name, which is like the last name in the alphabet. Okay. Yeah. Depends on how it's sorted. Sure. If we have a list of numbers as we had before, I'm assuming it's sorted, the smallest numbers are in the beginning, the biggest numbers are in the back. Yeah, that's true. So, what if it's sorted in descending order? How do you find the biggest list in the sorted list? Like that. If it's descending. So if the biggest numbers are in the beginning, the smallest are at the end. What's the biggest number? The first one, right? But you only have to look at one number if it's sorted. So sorting a list would improve, the running of this algorithm much more. It would be so easy, right? If I give you a list of a million numbers and ask you what's sorted and ask you what's the biggest number, you would answer me in 1 second. What if the product is divisible by 5? That's another question. So the product is multiplying all the elements of the list together. And the result, is that divisible by 5 or not? So given a list of numbers, is the product of the numbers divisible by 5? That can be a question. So let's try to do this one. I'll stop at 1:30, maybe. Stopping at 5? Stopping? All right, good. What was your method? Go ahead.
I multiply the second digit of each number, but I only pay attention to the last digit of the product.
To the last digit, and so you always keep just the last digit of the product, right? Only the last digit. Okay, I see. And so you only keep one number, one digit at one point. Okay, that's pretty good. That's gonna be pretty fast, right? If you were to do it. Any other ideas? Any other ways? Okay. Yeah.
Since 5 is a prime number, there's no need to worry about being able to build up something that's divisible by 5. So I just look for any single item which was divisible by 5.
Yes.
Is there worrying about?
Yes. Exactly. So the, you know, I want to say fastest, but I'm not sure. One other idea is to look, it's enough if you have a whole bunch of numbers and you want to test the product, if the product is divisible by 5. The one way to do it is to look for one number, at least one number that's divisible by 5. If you have one number that's divisible by 5 and you multiply it, that's going to make everything divisible by 5. Okay, let's take an example. So let's say your number is 4. If you multiply 4 by 5, that's going to give you 20. If you multiply, 7 by 5, that's going to give you 35. It's always going to, multiplying this list by any number that's divisible by 5 is going to make it divisible by 5. And so that's, fastest. But how long does that take? How long does Kevin's method take? How long does the method where we're looking for at least one number that's divisible by 5? Now, what's the best case? Yeah.
Minimum one, maximum, likeliest, average, half worst.
Okay, let's start with the minimum. When is the minimum happen?
The first number.
Okay, so the first number is divisible by 5. We've answered the question. Yes, it is, because we're multiplying a multiple of 5 by a whole bunch of numbers. It doesn't matter what those numbers are. The max, can you say that again? The average? Exactly. In the worst case, either the last element is divisible by 5, is the only element that's divisible by 5, or there's nothing divisible by 5. So you have to still run through the whole. So that's n. That's going to be n, a big O of n kind of method. So this is the same, in this method, you just multiply all the numbers together. You you have your item I of the list, and you have a product. And the product, you have to start, this is pretty important. So remember, for the sum of the numbers, you had to set the total to zero. And then you said,
okay, I'm minus this 48, 14, whatever. Total starts with zero. And then whatever I run into an element of the list, I add that element. So I add 48 to the total, that makes it 48. Then I add 40 to the total, that makes it 88. Then I add 14 to the total, that makes it 102. And so on. So I need to start with zero if I want to get the sum of all the numbers. If I want to do the product, if I start with zero, what's going to happen? Yes. Multiply by 40 times zero is zero. 40 times zero is zero. It's going to give me zero. It's going to ruin the whole thing. So I need to start with one. If I start with one, 1 times 48 is going to give me 48. 48 times 40 is however much that is, and so on. Right, so that's pretty important. So that's one difference between the script for the sum and the script for the product. And again, we run through the whole list. We each element, we multiply the current product with the item I of the list. And then we test if the product mod 5 equals 0. And if it is, we say yes. And if it's not, we say no. We're going to do this. Well, maybe we'll end with this. So the median of a list is the number in a sorted list, it's the number in the middle, right? So sometimes your professors give you, after a midterm or an exam, they say the median was this. That means in a sorted list of grades, that's the number in the middle. The problem is sometimes the list is not sorted. So the question is, is the median in the following list 45? I'll stop at 2:30. Stopping? People need more time? No? No? Okay. Stopping? Majority was right. Okay, we'll start talking about this next time.
email. Were you able to submit it to Sakai?
Yeah.
Okay, perfect. I'll let the team know. The TAs are responsible with it, but